o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon State Fair, Dia de la Familia, inviting you and your family to come out on Sunday, August 31st in Salem. A celebration of Latino culture, Dia de la Familia includes live Latin music, food, mariachi, ballet folklorico, face painting, and the Chemeketa Community College women's soccer team at the Kids Kick Camp.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, thousands of people gather in Ferguson, Missouri for the funeral of Michael Brown.
Israeli airstrikes continue in Gaza with an attempted ceasefire agreement rejected by Israeli officials.
We'll hear about a measure on the November ballot in Oregon to label genetically modified organisms. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 25th, 2014.
I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. I'm sorry. Okay. Little mix up. It's been over 2 weeks since Ferguson teenager Michael Brown was killed by a white police officer. Repeated calls for police report have been unanswered. Finally, according to the Office of St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Robert P. McCullough, no police report exists. McCullough, who has been accused of bias in favor of the police, admits calls for him to recuse himself from the case, claims that no report was ever filed because Ferguson police turned the case over to St. Louis County Police shortly after Michael Brown was killed. Meanwhile, in St. Louis, a new video of the police shooting and killing another black man a few days after the Ferguson shooting have emerged. This video totally contradicts the police version of the incident. The police claim that Kajimi Powell, a 25-year-old black man, was brandishing a knife and was threatening officers. Witnesses in the video contradict the police version of the event. Within 20 seconds of arriving on the scene, the police had shot and killed Powell. They claim that they cannot subdue him with a taser because he was wearing a sweatshirt, although the video shows that the sweatshirt was open on the front.
The funeral for teenager Michael Brown was held this past Saturday in Ferguson, Missouri. Brown's killing August 9th at the hands of Missouri police sparked nationwide protest against police violence and racism. Thousands of people attended the funeral today, and people respected the family's call that there be no protest today. Here's an excerpt from the funeral.
I'm here to bring this young man, and you know him. He was the lead attorney for Trayvon Martin's family. Now he's here in Ferguson as the lead attorney for the family of Michael Brown Jr. I want to bring to you attorney Benjamin Crump as he brings the Reverend Al Sharpton. Receive him at this time.
I will give a brief legal reference before I bring a man up who always answers the bell when we call. He answered the bell for Trayvon Martin. He answered the bell for Eric Garner. And he answered the bell of Michael Brown's family when his grandfather called while Michael Brown was yet on the ground for over 4.5 hours. It was 162 years ago, about 10 miles, Pastor Jones, from this great building where we say our founder respects to young Michael Brown Jr. Maxine Waters, they say that it's still referred to as the old courthouse where the Missouri Supreme Court issued the Dred Scott decision, Reverend Jackson. And the substance, Reverend Al, of that decision was that a person of African descent could not, nor were they ever, to be considered a citizen pursuant to the United States Constitution. Now, one could logically conclude, Bishop Jakes, that this follows the precedents set by the 1787 Three-Fifths Amendment that said an African American was to be considered three-fifths of a man. But we declare here today, as we pay our final respects to Michael Brown Jr., that he was not three-fifths of a citizen. He was an American citizen. And we will not accept three-fifths justice. We will demand equal justice for Michael Brown Jr. So with that legal reference, I bring to you one of the most influential civil rights leaders of our history, Reverend Al Sharpton.
I thought about how many of us were just considered nothing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How we were just marginalized and ignored. Whatever the circumstance an investigation lead to have that boy laying there. Like nobody cared about him. Like he didn't have any loved ones. Like his life value didn't matter. And I said, plug his grandfather through. I said, I don't know what happened, but whatever we can do, I'll be there to do it. That night, violence started. Next night, violence. We were here Tuesday. And we went in front of that old courthouse with Big Mike and with the mother. And they had to break their morning to ask folks to stop looting and rioting. Can you imagine their heartbroken, their son taken, discarded and marginalized, and they have to stop mourning to get you to control your anger like you more angry than they are. Like you don't understand that Michael Brown does not want to be remembered for a riot. He wants to be remembered as the one that made America deal with how we gonna police in the United States. This is not about you.
Not at all. Not at all.
This is about justice. This is about fairness. And America is going to have to come to terms with there's something wrong that we have money to give military equipment to police forces, but we don't have money for training and money for public education and money to train our children.
That was Reverend Al Sharpton speaking at the funeral of Michael Brown Jr., the teenager killed by police August 9th in Missouri. On Sunday, protests in Ferguson resumed, with police lined up along the streets with riot gear and military weapons. The protests continue in Ferguson today, with legal observers and supporters arriving from other parts of the country to call for an end to racial injustice and bias in Missouri and across the U.S.
The longtime political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal has issued a commentary on the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, as part of his prison radio series. Here's the latest commentary from Mumia.
The real outside agitators. As the days and nights of angry resistance rage on in Ferguson, Missouri, the corporate media embarks on its newest campaign, the proposed banning of outside agitators. It is ironic in the extreme to hear black reporters and black cops and indeed black activists launch a verbal attack against outside agitators when, were it not for such protesters during the hottest days and nights of the civil rights movement, they would not exist. For the phrase outside agitators was born in the minds and mouths of white southern segregationists who decried the arrival of white and black students from the north who worked to register voters, found freedom schools, and joined the Freedom Riders on buses to break state segregation laws. Remember the Southern Christian Leadership Conference? That's Martin King's organization. When SCLC staged marches in Alabama, that state's governor, George Wallace, called SCLC, quote, professional agitators with pro-communist affiliations, unquote. Sound familiar? How close to outside agitators? The phrase begs the question, outside of what? The state? America? This country is called the United States of America, founded upon a constitution. Do all people have the right to protest, or just certain residents? Is what happened to Mike Brown a local matter, or is this really a national issue? It's not the job of media to police protests, pitting good demonstrators against bad ones. Their job is to report, period. Were it not for these protests, let us be frank, the media would have ignored the story. If the media was doing its job, reporting on the vicious state violence launched against young blacks the nation over, perhaps Mike Brown would be alive today. Let us look at the cops, almost 98% of whom are outside and outsiders to Ferguson. They work there, they kill there, but they don't live there. They dwell in neighboring whiter counties and towns. Who are the real outside agitators from imprisoned nation? This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Clackamas County sheriffs managed to chase down a subject who fled from police first in a pickup, then by foot, and took him into custody without shooting or injuring him. The suspect in the case, David Orrick, was a 43-year-old white male. After a car chase that ended at the suspect's apartment complex, he ran inside and holed up in his apartment. Officers managed to talk him down and take him into custody. He was wanted on several warrants, including DUI and possession of methamphetamine.
An apartment manager in Washington County was stabbed to death late last week while posting eviction notices in the apartment complex. Nicole Lobb had recently started working at the Timber Creek Apartments in Cedar Mill when she was killed last Tuesday. Her friends have set up an account on GoFundMe.com. The account is called Help a Murder Victim's Kids. People have already donated $500, and there's a $5,000 goal. One friend who started the fund says that it's meant for Nicole's kids to help with their college education or just immediate school supplies, food, and clothes. Nicole Lobb was killed at 5 in the evening, but no witnesses have come forward, and investigators say they have no leads in the case.
At the Music Video Awards in Los Angeles this weekend, singer Miley Cyrus sent a homeless youth to the stage to accept the award on her behalf. Here's the speech he gave to a surprised Hollywood audience. Yeah, I just closed my
eyes. Thank you all. My name is Jesse, and I am accepting this award on behalf of the 1.6 million runaways and homeless youth in the United States who are starving, lost, and scared for their lives right now. I know this because I'm one of these people. Thank you. I've survived in shelters all over the city. I've cleaned your hotel rooms. I've been an extra in your movies. I've been an extra in your life. Though I may have been invisible to you on the streets, I have a lot of the same dreams that brought many of you here tonight. Los Angeles Entertainment Capital has the largest population of homeless youth in America. The music industry will make over $7 billion this year, and outside these doors are 54,000 human beings who have no place to call home. Yeah, thank you. If you want to make powerful change in the world right now, please join us and go to Miley's Facebook page. A dream you dream alone is only a dream, but a dream we dream together is reality. Thank you so much for your time.
Cyrus said that by handing over the microphone to the young man, she hoped to bring attention to the issue of homeless youth in California and across the country.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Cindy Corey, the mother of the late peace activist Rachel Corey, who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer. She'll speak about a port blockade of an Israeli ship this past weekend in Tacoma, Washington. This will be followed by Labor Radio, the voice of Oregon's working people, at 6. Prison Pipeline is at 6:30, and at 7 it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 92 degrees.
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Lawyers will tell you that any good prosecutor could convince a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Well, meet that ham sandwich. A Texas grand jury has just indicted Governor Rick Perry, a real ham, only not as smart. He's charged with official abuse of power, specifically threatening to veto all state funding for a public integrity unit that, among other things, was investigating corrupt favoritism in one of the governor's pet projects. Perry was trying to muscle out of office the woman who is the duly elected head of that unit, presumably to halt its inquiry. "Leave office," he publicly barked at her, "or I'll take away all your money." She didn't, and he did. Not smart, for that's an illegal quid pro quo, much like linking a campaign donation to an official favor. This led to a judge, a special prosecutor, a grand jury, and now the indictment of the gubernatorial ham sandwich. Perry and his Republican operatives quickly denounced and even threatened both the special prosecutor and the jurors as partisan hacks who, in Rick's words, quote, will be held to account. Thuggish as that is, the national media have mostly swallowed Perry's hokum that he's the victim, indicted for nothing more than exercising his veto power. "It's crude politics," Rick howled as he turned his courthouse mugshot moment into a raucous Republican political rally. This is Jim Hightower saying, Perry has hornswoggled the pundits, but don't let them fool you. This is serious. Again, the issue is not Perry's veto, but his linking of a veto threat to his effort to oust an elected public official. As for his hamming it up about being a poor victim of Democrats, the judge who appointed the prosecutor is a Republican, and the prosecutor himself was nominated to federal office by President Bush I and endorsed by 2 of Texas Republican senators.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says a political revolution that mobilizes millions of working people who aren't politically active is needed to solve very serious economic and social problems facing working Americans. In a speech to the Iowa AFL-CIO, Sanders outlined an action agenda to save the middle class and take on corporate power.
We need a political revolution in which we involve millions and millions of people, working people, low-income people, young people, people of color, who are not now involved in the political process. We're not going to make the changes we need if the pundits are right and voter turnout in this coming election is 40%. If that's the case, the Koch brothers win. So we have got to figure out a way to galvanize millions of people whose lives depend upon what happens in Washington to get involved in the political process.
Sanders says trade policies have to be changed, job creation must be done, and the wealth and income gap must be narrowed.
The wealthiest people in this country are getting richer, while the middle class is disappearing, and while we have more people living in poverty than any time in the history of America. If we don't deal with this issue, we are not going to have a middle class in this country. Many of the new jobs that have been created since the Wall Street crash, many of these new jobs are part-time and low-wage. We have got to make certain that every American who works 40 hours a week makes a living wage, does not live in poverty. And what that means is we got to raise the minimum wage. In Congress now, we're looking at $10.10 an hour, not as high as I would like to go, but if we could even pass that, it would mean providing a wage increase for some 25 million Americans who desperately need it. and that is what we have to do.
Senator Sanders says Congress needs to focus on job creation and on lifting wages of all working Americans to living wages. Sanders says real unemployment is much worse for working people than the official national number of 6.1%. Representative Paul Ryan denied he would cut Medicare when asked about it point blank at a book tour stop in Florida on Sunday. An unidentified man asked Ryan point blank whether he would cut Medicare.
I'm 61. Are you planning any cuts to Medicare?
No. And if you're in or near retirement, nothing will change.
It's very important.
I know it is. We want to save it for the next interview.
But Ryan's Medicare plan would in fact cut Medicare by replacing the guarantee of health care coverage with a premium support voucher system. The Los Angeles Times says the House GOP has revived Ryan's austere budget and Medicare cuts, and the Congressional Budget Office reports that the Ryan plan would raise Medicare premium payments by 50% for seniors, while also raising the Medicare eligibility age to 67. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The end of a destructive wildfire season in the Pacific Northwest is in sight, according to fire crews. Washington crews have contained four large fires in the past 24 hours. The Little Bridge Creek and Upper Falls fires are now 100% contained. But exceptional drought conditions are ongoing in California, where a lack of rain has created a tinderbox condition in which forests can ignite easily and fires can spread extremely quickly. After evacuating areas around Yosemite National Park last week, firefighters in California now say that they have the fire over 75% contained.
The 20-member Citizens Initiative Review Commission has narrowly voted against recommending passage of Oregon Measure 92, which calls for the mandatory labeling of genetically modified food products, or GMOs. The decision came after 4 days of debate and discussion at the Salem Convention Center. The 20 panelists on the commission, who were randomly selected to match Oregon demographics, heard testimony from expert witnesses both for and against the measure. The review commission's findings will appear in the official voter's guide before the November election. For more information, I spoke with Sandeep Kaushik, spokesperson for Oregon Right to Know's Yes on 92 campaign.
The 20-member Citizens Initiative Review Commission narrowly voted against recommending passage of the Oregon Mandatory Labeling of GMOs Initiative, or Measure 92. How was the panel organized?
It was a panel of folks drawn from around the state. It was, as you mentioned, a narrow vote. It was an 11-9 vote, and we did come up on the short end of that, which is a little bit disappointing, but there were also some... There were both some lessons learned here, as well as some positive things that came out of the finding of the commission as well.
First, I wanted to find out how the panel actually came to a decision. These were 20 people who were randomly selected?
That's correct. They were randomly selected, and they were convened in Salem for a three-day process starting late Thursday and then going through the weekend. They heard presentations from supporters on our side as well as supporters of the opposition. And they made a series of key findings as well as determinations of what they thought the strongest arguments on both sides were, and then they took that final vote.
What factors then influenced the panel to vote against the measure? And, of course, it was narrow. It was 11-9, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it was a very close vote. I think in the end that, unfortunately, the out-of-state chemical companies and agribusiness giants that are funding our opposition were able to mislead a slim majority of the participants by relentlessly pushing some discredited or outdated cost studies related to previous campaigns. One of the things that we took away as a strong positive when they ranked their key findings, the top finding was actually a statement that was supportive of our position. So the finding that had the most support on the panel was a finding that labeling genetically engineered foods would provide information to let Oregonians make more informed buying decisions, and this would offer them control and transparency over their food purchasing decisions. That's a core argument of our campaign. But yes, unfortunately, some of this false and misleading cost claims from the other side had just enough traction in this venue to lead to that narrow vote.
Oh, Sandeep, also somewhat ironically, one of the in the report, one of the arguments mentioned why the majority voted against recommended against passage. They said under Measure 92, if passed, meat and dairy products from animals that have been raised and fed with genetically engineered feed and grade will not be labeled genetically modified or GM. In a way, they're saying that the measure doesn't go far enough.
Well, this is an example of the kind of cynical and disingenuous argument that's very typical of the other side. Of course, they don't think that people should oppose the initiative because it doesn't go far enough. And the reality is, if we had the reality is that our initiative, Measure 92, complies with the same labeling standard that has been implemented in the vast majority of the 64 other countries that require labeling. And this is not a new idea. 64 other countries have already adopted labeling. We know that it works in those countries. We know that it hasn't raised costs. We know that just as in those countries, they require meat and dairy that is genetically engineered to be labeled. We do that with Measure 92. It doesn't make sense and would be unduly burdensome to require meat and dairy that just might have at some point have consumed some genetically engineered crops to then be labeled. And think about it. It's a common sense thing. Just because you eat an ear of genetically engineered corn, that doesn't make you genetically engineered. And the same exact thing is true of livestock or dairy.
Now, many people are predicting that this might be one of the costliest campaigns in Oregon history. A similar measure was on the ballot in California and Washington in the past few years, and voters voted against it, probably somewhat as a result of heavy lobbying by the food industry. Do you expect something similar here with similar arguments?
We expect them to use the exact same playbook and to spend huge amounts and very likely record amounts of money to try to confuse the issue and to cynically try to manipulate voters into voting against the initiative. They did, as you mentioned, they did it in California where they spent $46 million. They did it in Washington State where they spent a record $22 million. And the most important thing to recognize about what they did in Washington, when you look at the list of contributors, there were just 12 contributors that gave $22 million. There were a handful of individuals that wrote small contributions, and then there were six chemical and agribusiness giants and the Grocery Manufacturers Association that between them wrote checks from $500,000 all the way up to more than $11 million. These are a handful of big corporations that have a huge vested interest in protecting the profits they make off the sale of GMO foods. And that's really what they're concerned about. They're not concerned that there's some, you know, the initiative doesn't go far enough or, you know, that it doesn't cover this or that. They have a self-interested concern in protecting their own bottom lines, and they think that should take precedence over giving Oregonians the information they need to make informed choices about what they choose to eat and feed their family.
We've been talking with Sandeep Kaushik, spokesperson for the Oregon Right to Know's Yes on 92 campaign. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
A new study has found that states which allow medical marijuana have much lower rates of overdose deaths from prescription drugs. In the United States, 46 people die each day from drug overdoses. Most of these deaths are from people addicted to opioids such as Vicodin and Oxycontin. However, lately, the 13 states with medical marijuana have noticed a 25% drop in deaths by drug overdose. In a report today in the Journal of American Medical Association, researchers hypothesize that the states with legalized medical marijuana have fewer deaths by overdose. One of the co-authors to the study, Colleen Berry, noted that the shift in drug overdoses was striking, with significant changes showing up in each state within a year of legalization. The naysayers give the credit for the reduction of deaths to states changing their policies on the overprescribing of opiate medications. The authors of the study point out that it is basically impossible to die from an overdose of pot, and that pot is much less toxic than opiate drugs. States that pass progressive laws to treat addiction may be more likely to lower their rates of overdose deaths. For political reasons, these states may also be more likely to legalize medical marijuana.
A civil liberties organization has filed a federal lawsuit against the state of Oklahoma, challenging that state's decision to block the viewing of an execution when the execution began to go wrong. The American Civil Liberties Union filed the lawsuit on behalf of the Oklahoma Observer and the Guardian after the botched execution of Clayton Lockett in April. A staff attorney for the ACLU claims that the state of Oklahoma violated the First Amendment, which guarantees that the press has the right to view and report on executions performed by the state. In this particular execution, the drugs being used were not the approved drugs for executions, and the drugs being used were not identified by the state of Oklahoma. The lawsuit demands that the witnesses be guaranteed the right to view the condemned person from the minute they enter the death chamber until they leave. In the case of the execution of Clayton Lockett, the witnesses were not allowed to see into the chamber when Lockett arrived and while the intravenous needles were inserted. The blinds were raised for only about 20 minutes while the drugs were being administered, but closed immediately when Lockett began to writhe and moan and speak, which normally is not possible with approved drugs. The blinds were lowered again for another 20 minutes, during which time the witnesses continued to hear pain and distress coming from Lockett. State officials said they were calling off the execution, but then said that the condemned man had died of a heart attack. Katie Fretland, a plaintiff in the case, was present as a witness for The Guardian and The Observer. Fretland said that the purpose of the press at executions is to be the eyes and ears of the public and that the government does not have the right to hide the proceedings or to blindfold the public when things go wrong. The public has the right to know the real story, not just an edited version by the government.
A Liberian doctor has died since receiving the experimental drug ZMAP in a Congolese hospital in Jira. Two other people who had received the treatment have not died and were recently released from hospitals in the United States. A Spanish doctor who was infected and received the experimental drug ZMAP also died from the disease. There have only been six people who have received the controversial new drug known as ZMAP, three of whom have died. Ebola has a 90% death rate and no known cure. Researchers are desperately searching for a more effective treatment for Ebola, which has already killed over 2,000 people in Western Africa. Today's cases mark the first appearance of the disease in the Congo in the Jira region. Jira is a series of equatorial villages about 750 miles outside of Kinshasa. According to the health minister, the villages of Jira have now been placed under quarantine.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, August 25th, 2014. Death toll in Gaza reaches 2,134 as Israeli war enters its 49th day. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli settlers and troops attacks leave one teenager killed and another injured. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. At least 12 Palestinian civilians were killed on Monday as Israeli attacks on Gaza continues for the past 49 days. According to local sources, among those killed on Monday was Abdullah Murtaga, a Palestinian journalist. Murtaga was killed when Israeli tanks bombarded a residential area in a Shuja'iya neighborhood in Gaza City on Monday morning. 10 more civilians were injured in the attack. The Palestinian Ministry of Health announced that with those killed today, the death toll have reached 2,134, including 578 children. Moreover, around 10,895 civilians were injured due to the Israeli war in Gaza that started on July 8th, the ministry added. In related news, Egypt has proposed a new ceasefire for Gaza, which would open the border crossings, allowing in aid and reconstruction materials, according to Palestinian sources. Palestinian leadership, including Hamas, would be willing to accept the deal if Israel does, the sources told AFP. Up until the time of this report, no Israeli official response were made to the Egyptian proposal. While Israeli aerial, ground and sea bombardment continued today, Palestinian resistance groups managed to fire 120 missiles into Israeli areas surrounding Gaza, the Israeli military announced. Damage was reported, but no casualties. Elsewhere, a Palestinian child died on Monday of serious injuries suffered after the army opened fire at Palestinians near the northern West Bank city of Nablus last Friday. Hassan Ashour, age 15, was shot by several rounds of live ammunition in the chest and liver and was later declared clinically dead until he passed away on Monday morning. Local sources said that the child was wounded during clashes, which took place at the Beit Furik Israeli military roadblock east of Nablus after the soldiers assaulted several Palestinians. Later on Monday evening, a Palestinian teenager was shot and injured by Israeli settlers' gunfire at the village of Beit Umar near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. According to witnesses, settlers attacked local youth near the settlement of Karmein Sur, illegally built on lands taken from local farmers. Doctors said that the boy, 16 years of age, was moved to Hebron Hospital for treatment after he was hit in his right hand and abdomen. His injuries were described as moderate. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, August 25th, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
An examination of the most recent release of NSA documents from Edward Snowden has shown a possible link between the right-wing ISIS group and the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad. The documents reveal that British and American intelligence and the Mossad worked together to create the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known by its acronym ISIS. According to the documents, the intelligence agencies worked together to create a terrorist organization meant to attract various extremists to a single group using a strategy they called the Hornet's Nest. Among the statements attributed to intelligence agents in the leaked documents was a quote that the only solution for the protection of the Jewish state is to create an enemy near its borders. Leaks also revealed that ISIS leader and cleric Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi took intensive military training for a year with agents of the Mossad. Al-Baghdadi also took courses in theology and the art of speech from Israeli agents.
The lawsuit filed by U.S. Navy sailors exposed to radiation from Fukushima goes to court today in San Diego. The sailors aboard the USS Ronald Reagan had one lawsuit dismissed in March, but filed amended charges against TEPCO, the Fukushima nuclear power plant's owner. The lawsuit asked the court to award $1 billion in damages to over 110 sailors suffering from illnesses they say was directly caused by their exposure to radiation while conducting humanitarian rescue missions in the aftermath of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. At least 40 of the sailors have been diagnosed with cancer since being exposed to radiation that was released from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The U.S. Navy's official pronouncement is that radiation exposure levels were small and not harmful. In other Fukushima news, the cases of childhood cancers in the Fukushima province continues to grow. The total number of childhood thyroid cancers has grown to 104. Historically, the number of cancers would be less than 5 out of the 300,000 children tested. The Japanese government has publicly stated that they believe the cancers are not caused by Fukushima, as thyroid cancers related to Chernobyl did not occur until the fourth year, and the Fukushima accident occurred 3 years ago. Meanwhile, rice grown in Fukushima province has gone on sale in supermarkets in Japan and Singapore.
An international team of scientists have concluded that worldwide supplies of fresh, clean water will be depleted in less than 30 years. The report pointed to several global trends, including population growth and energy production, that have worsened the problem. In India, within 15 years, water demand will be 50% higher than total available water. Up to 75% of all surface water in India is currently contaminated. In China, even though per capita water usage is less than one-third of global levels, clean water supplies are so low that almost 40% of all water used in agriculture was imported last year. 80% of all rivers in China are so contaminated they no longer support any aquatic life. In the Middle East, the Jordan River is at 2% of its historical average. In the United States Midwest, the Ogallala Aquifer has dropped from over 240 feet deep to under 80 feet in the last 80 years. In California and the Southwest United States, the 14-year long drought continues to worsen. In California's breadbasket, the San Joaquin Valley, water aquifer levels are dropping so fast that the ground is subsiding up to 11 inches per year in some areas, and water rationing for irrigation has been placed in effect. At Lake Mead, the main water supply for much of Arizona and Nevada, including Las Vegas, continues to drop dangerously low. If water levels continue to fall at the current rate, water rationing will become mandatory for Lake Mead water users by 2016. A main user of Lake Mead water, Las Vegas, is home to almost 600,000 residents and over 40 million visitors per year. Las Vegas gets an average of less than 4 inches of rain per year, but has one of the largest per capita water usage rates in the United States.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zier, Henry Leisha, Rosalind Scott, and Ken Jones. Our engineer is Mike Fitoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the host asks if we could be looking at a major shift in the balance of power in the Arab world. Call in with your thoughts. At 9, on Alternative Radio, journalist and author David K. Johnson speaks on the societal impact of inequality. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host DeMay Roberts speaks with Michelle Fuji, who was artistic director of Portland Taiko for 9 years, and her husband Toru Watanabe. They just formed their own Taiko group called Unit Susu. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews the poster artist Emek about his drawing and printing methods. his move from L.A. to Blue Lake, and his love of music. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Mike, and good night, Ken.
Good night, Rosalyn. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Cindy Corey. She is the mother of the late Rachel Corey, who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer in 2003. Cindy, I wonder if you could start by telling us why you decided to take part in a port blockade in Tacoma, Washington this past weekend.
Like many, many people that have been watching the developments in Gaza during these past weeks, I just have been horrified at the numbers of people who have died, the number of children who have died, the amount of destruction, the number of displaced people. It's an unprecedented number. I just read the UN report for today, and there are over a quarter of the population of Gaza is displaced by what's going on. And I believe I've been a supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And when we learned that these Israeli ships, ships were coming into West Coast ports, and we heard that people were organizing in Oakland and elsewhere to see if we could send a message that as long as Gaza remains under siege, as long as the port of Gaza, which is, has not been able to operate now for years, as long as that is continues to be blocked, that we want to challenge Israeli ships coming to our West Coast ports. So that's really why I decided that I could join the many other people who decided to come out early, very early on Saturday morning and throughout Saturday in Tacoma, and who are again coming out today in Seattle.
And I understand that opening the port of Gaza is one of the terms that have been given by Hamas for the ceasefire that has been rejected by Israel. Is that part of the reason that you decided that blocking the port might be a good action, is to bring attention to that fact of the port not being open in Gaza for so many years?
It is. For me, I think it's a really a direct connection. And I'm really hopeful that longshore workers here in the United States will come to better understand that connection. I've been on Gaza beaches, and I've met with Gaza fishermen. I have, you know, watched how fishermen, local fishermen, have been kept from going out and fishing each day. They were, under Oslo Agreement, supposed to be able to go 12 nautical miles, under international law, I believe, 20 nautical miles. And really, even to get, even when there have been agreements to go as far as 6 nautical miles, they've often been shot upon when they've gone 2 or 3. Their boats have been confiscated. And certainly there's been no ability to take ships in and out of the port. We know what happened with the Mavi Marmara and the flotillas that tried to come to the Gaza port when on the Mavi Marmara, 10 people were killed when those ships were boarded by the Israeli forces. So I think there's a direct connection, and I'm really hoping that we can raise awareness and that we can encourage, as I said, longshore workers here to stand in solidarity with the people of Gaza so that their port can be open. What a very strong message from my friends in Gaza and from people, others that I've heard from coming out of this, is that this siege has gone on far too long. People just can't tolerate it any longer. And, you know, the situation in Gaza got worse in the last year and a half since the Egyptian government changed, since the military took over there. And I, you know, it was quiet, but it was very, very bad for people in Gaza. And people just aren't willing to return to that. And I understand, having been there, I understand why they feel that way. And I just feel like we've got to do what we can to make sure that some semblance of a normal life can be demanded and obtained for people there.
Now, you mentioned the longshore workers. The International Longshore Warehouse Union was among the first to come out to oppose the South African apartheid system, and they actually refused to unload South African ships during the 1980s. Nelson Mandela pointed to that as an example of solidarity internationally that helped bring down the apartheid system. In Oakland last week, a number of longshore workers refused to cross the picket line that the protesters had set up. What was the experience in Tacoma this past weekend with the workers? Were there workers that respected the picket line?
We, you know, it's very hard for us to know exactly what happened. There were a number of different entrances to the port. We do know that some workers did get in through different entrances, and that at least some of the goods we expect were unloaded. But it's very hard to know who showed up and who didn't. What we were surprised to see happen is that rather than the terminal where the workers were supposed to come, they went through a different terminal completely. So there, we know there needed to be coordination. We think that probably delayed the ship actually arriving, which in itself would be a victory. It's very hard to determine just how many people didn't cross that picket line, but we do know that there are people who very much support, that there are longshore workers who support the actions that are taking place. And we're grateful for that. We're immensely grateful for that.
And the shipping line that's being targeted is the Zim line out of Israel. Why target this particular line?
Well, my understanding is that it is primarily an Israeli company. They have the largest ownership in it. And we are, of course, have been targeting through BDS any of the companies and businesses that profit from the occupation. And, of course, in one way or another, most of the companies in Israel and institutions there are complicit in some way in the continuing occupation and in this blockade and siege of Gaza.
And when people talk about boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel, it's meant to have an economic impact on the country. What role do you think that plays in the struggle against the apartheid policies of Israel?
We've seen for now so many years the failure of governments and the failure of a peace process, and we did. You brought up South Africa, and one thing I think many people believe that this is a historic moment because of the actions that were successful in bringing about change in South Africa. Some of that happened through the ports. Certainly BDS will have some economic impact, but. There are a lot of different ways, I think, just in the minds of people, that it influences how people respond. It was actually, I know, sports teams not being able to travel and to play in different parts of the world. When their sports teams from South Africa were no longer welcomed, when their ships were no longer welcome, that started to have a huge impact on people there. So I think as well as the actual economic impact, there are some other implications of all of this, too, that we hope can bring about the change that's so badly needed.
Speaking of sports team, the Israeli basketball team is scheduled to come to Portland to play a game against the Trailblazers in September. I know people are planning a protest of that and are calling on some of the Trailblazers to not participate or to challenge it. And I understand also that there is an upcoming blockade in Seattle of a transport ship, an Israeli transport ship that's being planned. Are you a part of that as well?
I am here as we speak, meeting with folks, and it's the same ship actually that was in Tacoma. It's I'm not sure of its actual location at the moment, but it's to be in port here in Seattle, and there's definitely a plan to try to discourage the unloading of that ship.
And do you feel, can you talk about the influence of your daughter's work before she was killed in Gaza in inspiring you to take on this mantle of challenging the Israeli oppression of Palestinians?
Oh, you know, Rachel brought her family to this issue, and we have been held in the hearts of so many people through these years and supported and encouraged in the work that we do. It's really the fact, I think, you know, that we've been able to travel to Gaza. Gazans, for the most part, are not able to go, leave there or to return. When they come back, it's so difficult. But Craig and I have been privileged to travel there 5 times. We were there in 2012, as Operation Pillar of Cloud started. We were there twice in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. And I think when you, I think just to hear about it, but certainly having walked in the rubble and having met with families whose family members were killed and injured during those operations makes it very hard not to, you know, we're just compelled to keep doing what we can do. Rachel talked about making commitments to places, and I think to the extent that we're able to do that, we just continue to be